From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Millions of people on the West Coast woke up to another day of smoke and fire. In California alone, 28 major wildfires are burning and 16,000 firefighters are working to contain the destruction.
Dangerous levels of smoke is also forcing people to stay indoors. But during his visit to California yesterday, President Trump continued to dismiss climate change as a cause contributing to the fires burning throughout the West Coast. And California Governor Gavin Newsom confronted the president during a news conference.
We obviously feel very strongly that the hots are getting hotter, the dries are getting drier. When we're having heat domes the likes of which we've never seen in our history, the hottest August ever in the history of the state, the ferocity of these fires, the drought 5+ years, losing 163 million trees to that drought, something's happened to the plumbing of the world.
Democratic candidate Joe Biden has also called the president a climate arsonist who won't take responsibility for the wildfires. Molly Peterson is a science reporter for KQED, and she joins us now from Southern California with the latest. And Molly, President Trump and Gavin Newsom have really gone back and forth on this issue of climate change and who is at fault many times before, the biggest sticking point being what entity is actually in charge of forest management. What role does state forest management actually play in the level of intensity we're seeing right now?
Well, the state of California only controls about 3% of the land that's at risk for burning here. The federal government is in charge of 57% of forest lands that might burn and are burning. But the philosophy that got us here, where we suppressed fires, where we didn't treat vegetation in these forests, where we left them more and more at risk, that was kind of a group effort. I mean, overall, the forest management issue that I see in Southern California right now is in the Angeles National Forest, managed by the federal government. The Bobcat fire is burning out of control in part because they haven't had fire there 50, 60, 70 years where this fire is going.
Okay, you mentioned the Bobcat fires. There's so many fires burning. What's the latest here in California on that front?
Yeah, I see that we have 29 actually active major fires in California. Overall, since the year's begun, we've burned more than around three and a half million acres. That's double the previous record, which was just a couple of years ago, including one fire in Northern California, the August Complex Fire, which itself is nearing 1 million acres. And some of these fires aren't going to be out until basically the election.
Smoke and ash is now a really big deal. It's made air quality here on the West Coast the worst in the world. How dangerous is it?
Yeah, I saw this morning on IQ Air, Portland, Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco all have terrible PM2.5. That's the pollution from wood smoke. One pulmonologist in the Bay Area said it was like smoking 8 cigarettes to go outside. Wood smoke and air pollution decreases lung function. We're talking about wildfire smoke, too, which is more dangerous than planned burns in forests because chemically we've got fire consuming not just trees, but cars and paint and plastics and whatever else is in its path.
We heard Governor Gavin Newsom talk about the weather patterns. They have been all over the place. I mean, how has this impacted the severity of these fires and really the efforts to fight them?
Well, we had that record heat, we had that unusual wind event, we had that humidity in August. All of that was almost freakish, and it caused those lightning strikes that caused all those fires. Now we've got smoke creating its own weather, and that's confounding predictions about how fire will behave. That's confounding predictions about what the temperature is going to be. So this is a real man-made problem.
Yeah, with the little bit of time I have with you, you report extensively on climate change and wildfires. What are you watching for in the next few days?
I'll be watching for who our systems are leaving vulnerable. We've got unhoused people, people who have to work in fields or warehouses who are vulnerable to smoke, people, black and brown populations all over California who are already at risk for bad air quality because of where they live. We've got 24 people who've died in California, and many of them are older, and that's going to continue to be a risk.
There's also the issue of manpower. Firefighters are working around the clock and they've got lots of outside crews to help, but there is still a shortage. That's KQED science reporter Molly Peterson. Thank you so much, Molly.
Thank you.
President Trump will be in Pennsylvania tonight for a town hall discussion. His rival Joe Biden has been spending a lot of time in the Keystone State as well. Biden leads in the polls there, but not always by that much. There is also a tight House race this year for Pennsylvania's 10th congressional district. That's where Republican incumbent Scott Perry is facing a challenge from Democrat Eugene DePasquale, the state's auditor general. And that is where we touch down for this week's Here and Now District Profile series, looking at House races across the country. Katie Meyer, political reporter at WHYY in Philadelphia, joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about this district. The lines were redrawn recently after the state's Supreme Court ruled that the previous boundaries were gerrymandered and unconstitutional. Where is this district and where does it lean politically?
Sure. So this is right in central Pennsylvania, south central. So think Harrisburg, which is the capital, as well as the city of York down in York County. But, you know, the interesting thing about this is that when Scott Perry was first elected, the district was more rural. He lost a bunch of his more conservative rural base when there was the redistricting that happened in 2018. So he suddenly found himself, he's a very conservative Republican, suddenly found himself in a much more moderate district. And so, you know, and you said it yourself, you know, it's been a dead heat, basically. And so that is a function more than anything, I think, of Perry kind of having to rejigger his strategy to work in a different district.
Well, and Scott Perry is an Iraq War veteran. He's a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee in the House. He's also part of the House Freedom Caucus, the conservative group. And earlier this month, he spoke with Fox News about violence that has taken place at some protests this summer. Listen.
We have a system in the United States of America to work out our differences without violence. That's one of the reasons why it's a great country. We resort to violence to resolve our disputes, and we become like a lot of other places in the world where it's unsafe and unstable.
Tell us about Scott Perry's record in office, and what is he running on?
So I think the easiest way to think about Scott Perry is, you know, he is a fiscal conservative, he's pretty socially conservative, and he's allied himself closely with President Trump. Mm-hmm. When you look at this stuff, it's two candidates who are really fighting a very similar type of battle to the battle we're seeing at the top of the ticket. You know, Scott Perry casting himself in the mold of Trump, and DePasquale, meanwhile, casting himself as a Biden-esque, you know, working class roots Pennsylvania Democrat. You know, the race really mirrors the top of the ticket.
Well, let's talk about DePasquale. He's the auditor general, formerly served in the State House of Representatives. He spoke in a recent ad about his working class upbringing and working in his family's restaurant. Listen.
When I wasn't bussing tables, I umpired Little League games and worked as a janitor to pay for college. I learned a lot of life lessons from the people in my neighborhood. In Congress, I'll be on your side because this community deserves a level playing field. Not a system stacked against it.
Does DePasquale align himself pretty closely with Biden? Is he talking a lot about Biden?
He does, yeah. And I think you'll see this in the sort of distinctions he makes on his, you know, major policy positions. So, for instance, you saw Scott Perry saying that DePasquale, you know, supports defunding the police. DePasquale says, no, I want to, you know, look at how police are funded and maybe think about different ways to do it and different ways to reform so, you know, shootings don't happen. But I don't want to defund the police. Same as, like, he doesn't really want a single-payer healthcare system, but he wants a public option built on the Affordable Care Act. You know, he wants, you know, greener infrastructure, but he's not on board with the Green New Deal. So those kinds of careful positions that are designed to appeal to a more moderate Pennsylvania voter.
What are the polls saying?
The polls are really close. I mean, they go back and forth, but we can really think about this as a statistical dead heat. You know, this is going to be one of the closest congressional races in the country, no question.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the presidential race, because I'm sure we're going to be very focused on Pennsylvania over the next, you know, many weeks until election day. What are you seeing there? You're in Philadelphia. You know, it's the suburbs around Philadelphia that often determine what happens with Pennsylvania.
Sure. Yeah. The suburbs are going to be really important. You know, you saw Trump struggle a little bit more to get suburban votes than other Republicans had in recent elections. I also think that one of the things that needs to be paid attention to in Pennsylvania is high turnout in rural areas, because that's really what tipped Trump over the line, mm-hmm. as well as in former like blue collar areas. Mm-hmm. You'll see that in the way the candidates are approaching those areas as well. You know, Biden's from the northeast part of Pennsylvania, that area where Trump's been doing really well. He's from Scranton, and you've seen him really stress that in his campaign messaging. And you've seen Trump kind of trying to lay a claim to that area as well, saying, like, you know, I'm the person you liked that you voted for. And now he needs to get that same level of support or, you know, shore up those margins even more if he wants to win again.
That is Katie Meyer, political reporter with WHYY in Philadelphia. Katie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
A few years ago, my daughter was a big K-pop fan, especially the group BTS. And from the first time I heard them, I thought, this sounds like 90s R&B. BTS, of course, is one of the first K-pop groups to blow up here in the United States, and it's no secret how much Black American culture has influenced K-pop music at large. But now these groups are facing a call to action that has come along with embracing American culture, and that's activism. Crystal Anderson has been looking into this, tracing the many connections between Black American popular music and K-pop. Her new book on the subject is called Soul in Seoul, African American Popular Music and K-pop. She's also an affiliate Korean Studies faculty member at George Mason University. Crystal, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here.
Well, you know, earlier this summer, U.S. K-pop fans mobilized to support Black Lives Matter. They used their massive and collective power on social media to do this. And the company behind BTS, Big Hit, actually responded and donated $1 million to BLM. But they were an outlier within K-pop, and fans wanted more from their K-pop idols. What was the conflict here?
The conflict is that Korea has its own culture, and more importantly, it has a specific kind of mission for its outward-facing Korean artists, particularly the pop groups. So the pop groups are supposed to have a very positive image of Korea. So it's not new, but what is new is that the United States has a particular kind of history, and it has a particular kind of history in relation to South Korea. So I think going forward, what we're going to see is a different kind of negotiation of that relationship.
This is really interesting. And you lay this out somewhat in your book. Your book also really lays out the influence Black American artists have had on K-pop artists. And it's significant. We'll listen to a bit of those influence in just a moment. But how did this connection between Black American pop and Korean pop even come to be?
Well, it was there at the beginning. Most histories of K-pop, and we're talking about contemporary Korean popular music, and one of the first groups drew on hip-hop and R&B of the 1990s. And so it's really there at the beginning.
Under the huge umbrella of this genre, you note that there are three types of artists: K-pop groups, R&B, and hip-hop. And you selected some songs that are K-pop in various genres, and also some comparisons to popular Black American artists in the U.S. for us to listen to. First, let's listen to your picks in the K-pop groups category. KC and JoJo's All My Life up against 2PM's Wanna Love You Again.
I want you, baby. 내 머릿속에서 떠나지 않아.
I mean, hearing them back to back, we really do hear the influence there. Why did you pick these two songs to compare?
I chose these two songs because 2PM is kind of on the sexier end of the spectrum of K-pop idol groups. But what people may not realize is that the group also boasts a very significant bank of vocalists. But going through their discography, I kept coming across these R&B ballads, and they were R&B ballads with no qualification. And I thought that would be a really great comparison to Casey and JoJo. And so you can hear very clearly those similarities.
And I want to talk to you more. We'll talk in just a moment about that influence, but then how transparent many of these K-pop artists are about who they're influenced by. This next group, though, this is an example of R&B acts in the K-pop genre, and we have Can't Stop Loving You by Korean artist Brown Eyed Soul up against a song by Sly and the Family Stone. Let's listen.
Can't stop loving.
Okay, I hear it. What are the commonalities that you hear in these two?
So Brown Eyed Soul is a Korean R&B group, and they've had a changing lineup. But the constant is the founder, and that founder is a musician. And so the great thing about Brown Eyed Soul is that it shows that K-pop doesn't just draw from the contemporary music of its time. It also reaches back to older genres of Black popular music.
You know, a lot of music critics make the distinction between what K-pop is doing here, which you even say is a skill of hybridity versus what many white artists have done in the past by taking Black American blues music, for instance, and essentially stealing it. Why do you make this distinction?
Well, one thing that we can see in those instances is that often those songs that were initially written and performed by African American artists were covered by white performers to achieve popularity, but those covers were watered down versions of the original, and they were designed to suit the taste of a particular mainstream, and so would describe that mainstream as white. And the Black originators were not given credit. However, what I see in K-pop, and as you said at the beginning, it's hard to miss the R&B influence in K-pop. So I like to use the concept of citation. Much like you cite your sources for a news story or for a research paper, K-pop artists are citing the R&B music tradition, and they're doing so through authentic performances. And Brittany Cooper has used this term to describe this idea in relation to popular music, that the idea is to point the listener back to the original. So it's not a conspiracy and it's not hidden. In addition, K-pop creators have actually worked with African-American artists and producers to create this music. So that also reinforces that connection.
You also picked out some hip-hop artists to compare. We have Korean hip-hop artist Primary with the song 2 Weeks up against The Roots performing The Next Movement. Let's listen. Side note, Crystal, that was my jam back in the day. tell us more about these.
So I chose these two because there's a tradition of live instrumentation in hip-hop. In K-pop, Primary is a Korean musical producer on the hip-hop label Amoeba Culture. And when you listen to Primary's music, there is almost always live instrumentation. He does very little sampling. Just like you have that live instrumentation in The Next Movement, you have the rhythms of R&B, and you have rap all over that as well.
You know, we started off this convo talking about the stark cultural differences that were shown at the start of this country's racial reckoning back earlier in the summer. Do you see a future in which K-pop can sustain a fan base here and become a part of the musical landscape on a deeper level? What are some of the challenges in that effort here in the United States?
I would say some of the challenges include language. That's the primary challenge. The other challenge, though, is related to the history of the United States and its history with immigration, with Korea as a country, with the racial history in the United States itself, that colors the way that people perceive the cultural production of other countries. But I have often argued, if you look at other kinds of cultural production in the United States that are popular with subgroups, those are sustained in a far longer kind of way. One of my favorites is kung fu films, martial arts films from China, and samurai films from Japan to a certain extent, or something like anime. These are things that live in subcultures, but they are significant. So I think that you'll always have a subculture that's interested in K-pop, just like you have a subculture that's interested in Bollywood, in anime, in Chinese martial arts films. But the degree to which they infiltrate the mainstream, I think we just still have to see whether that's going to be sustained.
Crystal Anderson is the author of the new book, Soul in Seoul, African-American Popular Music and K-Pop. Crystal, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Sally could dump a history-making amount of rain from Mississippi to the Carolinas after the storm makes landfall on the Gulf Coast. Let's bring in Ray Hawthorne. He's a meteorologist with Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. And Ray, where is this storm right now, and what can you say about its track and the timing of landfall?
Yeah, the storm right now, Tanya, is located about 110 miles to the south of Mobile, Alabama. That position is also about 85 miles to the south-southwest of Pensacola, Florida. The storm is barely moving. It's moving to the northwest at about 2 miles per hour, so it's crawling along. It has top sustained winds of 85 miles per hour. The forecast track is causing the storm, or rather allowing the storm, to turn more toward the north as we head toward later tonight and into Wednesday, and it looks like landfall is going to be somewhere between the southeastern coast of Mississippi, say around the Biloxi area, and perhaps as far east as the Pensacola area and the Florida Panhandle around midday tomorrow.
That's interesting about just the way that it's moving, that it's so slow. Does that tell us anything about it, its intensity?
Yeah, it tells us really a lot about the potential for tremendous rainfall, which you mentioned a little bit earlier. There isn't a lot of steering high up in the atmosphere, so the storm is just barely moving along. And the slower it moves, the more rain it's likely to dump. We're expecting 10 to 20 inches of rain over a widespread area. There are likely going to be amounts as high as 30 inches. And that's the reason for the potential for historic flash flooding along the Gulf Coast, particularly in Alabama and also in the western part of the Florida Panhandle. And that'll be spreading into the Carolinas, I think, coming up on Thursday and into Friday.
Yeah, I mean, that really speaks to the danger being more so the flooding and what that will cause rather than the high winds that did so much damage when Hurricane Laura hit Louisiana last month. You're watching several storms. What do you have your eyes on besides Sally right now?
So there are three other named storms out there. Yesterday, there was an extra one on top of that, Renee, but that has dissipated. There is Hurricane Paulette, which moved directly over Bermuda yesterday. That's heading out to sea. We have Tropical Storm Teddy. That is likely to become a hurricane, and we think that is also going to stay out to sea. The odds are favoring that. There is Tropical Storm Vicky near the African coast. And Tanya, if you can believe it, there is another one that is likely to develop later on this week near the African coast. For the moment, outside of Sally, all of these other systems are likely to hold out at sea at least for the next week or so.
Wow, that's a lot to watch out for. I know folks who live in those regions are used to this time of year. But what are you seeing that really concerns you as you look at all of these coming towards those areas?
Yeah, the biggest concern I have in particular with Sally is just the amount of rainfall. If you recall, and you just mentioned a little bit earlier, Laura, the big concern with that was the strong winds, the Category 4 winds that impacted parts of southwestern Louisiana. This storm is completely different. It's moving much slower. It's a Category 1 hurricane, but we shouldn't be fixated on the category of the storm. The storm is moving slow, so water is going to be the big concern with this one. And sometimes there's a tendency to let your guard down when it's just rain, mm-hmm. except it's not just rain. There's going to be a lot of it here. And that is my major concern along the Gulf Coast. It's just a tremendous amount of rainfall and the potential for catastrophic flooding.
Ray Hawthorne is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Citigroup is making history by naming Jane Fraser as its new chief executive. She'll be the first woman to head a major U.S. bank. When she takes over in February, Fraser will replace CEO Michael Corbat, who unexpectedly announced his retirement after 8 years. By becoming CEO of Citigroup, Fraser puts a crack in one of the strongest glass ceilings in business. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And why are there so few women at the top of the banking world?
I think it sort of reflects the entire corporate world, which is that we tend to get an equal number of people coming into these businesses, but the funnel starts to close very dramatically as you rise up the ranks. So if an entry level in finance, you see 50-50 male-female hiring, by the time you get to the senior VP and C-suite level, you're seeing about 73% men, 27% women, and that's according to McKinsey. So look, they're trying to be more inclusive and thoughtful about accommodating careers, but frankly, there's something happening in the middle of that funnel where women are leaving the industry.
Well, how did Fraser do it? She's been at Citi for 16 years, most recently as the head of the Global Consumer Banking Division.
Well, I think she's been quite thoughtful about this. You know, she started her career at Goldman Sachs. She went to business school. And when she thought about going back to Goldman, she actually said this at a 2016 conference. She said, you know, when I looked at the women who were at Goldman and they were higher up in the ranks, they were sort of scary looking and none of them seemed happy. So she went to McKinsey as a consultant and then entered Citigroup. And I think at Citigroup, she became like the ultimate fixer. Like during the financial crisis, she ran the bank strategy decision and really got them unfurled from the Smith Barney brokerage. She went to the bank mortgage unit, cleaned that up. She went to Latin America to clean that part up. So it's almost like if you're such a great fixer, let's keep elevating you. And this can be actually a pattern for many women in corporate America.
Now, we talked about the glass ceiling. People know what that is. There's also something called a glass cliff. And I want you to tell us about that because Fraser is going to be taking the lead at Citi during a very challenging time economically.
Absolutely. And I think this glass cliff notion is what I was talking about as sort of being that ultimate fixer. The term glass cliff was first coined by University of Exeter researchers back in 2005. And it refers to this idea that a struggling company only will bring a woman leader in because they're struggling. So think about it from the woman's perspective. When you get to the upper ranks of power, you're actually in the most precarious position possible. And you've got this very high likelihood of failure. So we've used glass cliff to maybe characterize Marissa Mayer going to Yahoo, Ellen Powell at Reddit, Carly Fiorina at HP. And so I think that this is something that could be a trap, but, you know, hopefully we can see some better progress at Citi.
Are there other women at the banks right now who are right below the CEO level, who are CEOs in the making? Like, who will be next?
I don't know who will be next. Marianne Lake has been spoken about as a successor to Jamie Dimon, you know, but he may sort of clutch the wheel of the J.P. Morgan Chase car for, you know, his last dying breath, for all we know. There is a woman at Bank of America who potentially could succeed Brian Moynihan. Her name is Kathy Bessant. There are some other people who are high-ranking women, but I don't think that they're actually going to be successor material. The one person that really was seen as a big potential successor at Morgan Stanley was Ruth Porat. She left the company to go be the chief financial officer at Alphabet, the parent of Google. So that was one that kind of got away.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, women are also taking the brunt of job losses in this economy. The unemployment rate for women is higher than it is for men, even though just before the pandemic hit in December 2019, women outnumbered men in non-farm payroll employment, something that had only happened once before in 2009. Betsy Stevenson joins us. She's professor of public policy and of economics at the University of Michigan and former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. Professor, welcome.
Oh, it's my pleasure to talk with you today.
Well, and I will tell our listeners that the last time we talked to you was right before COVID-19 really took over. We spoke back in February about the gains that women had made in the workforce. And of course, within weeks from that conversation, everything changed. How has the economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic affected women's employment compared to men's?
Yeah, so two things have happened that have changed women's role and trajectory in the labor force. One is hopefully short-lived, and that's the fact that we had what you might even call a gendered shutdown. The kinds of industries that had to send people home, that shut down, disproportionately employed women. So some of the industries that took the hardest hit, like leisure and hospitality, that's an industry that's 53% women, and they had 58% of the job cuts in that industry. But a lot of people also didn't realize that health services jobs, they shut down non-essential care, and that is an industry where 78% of the workers are women. Mm-hmm. You know, they've brought most of those workers back, but not all. We're still down about 6% employment overall in education and health services. Well, education and health services has been the driver of the growth in jobs for women over the 21st century. Mm-hmm. So since 2000, 50% of the job growth for women has been in that sector, education and health services.
But you say that most of those jobs have come back already.
Yeah. So I said that there are two things that have happened. And the short-lived one is that shutdown. And I'm hoping a lot of these jobs are going to keep coming back. The second factor is one that's perhaps more deeply concerning, and that's been the childcare crisis. That's pushing a lot of women out of the labor force or pushing them to take different jobs or to cut back their hours or just make sacrifices because kids are at home and they've been home for a long time. They need a lot from their parents right now. And when push comes to shove, someone's career is going to get hurt.
Are you hopeful that women, though, will be able to recover fully and maybe relatively quickly from this recession?
I think how long it takes women to recover is going to depend on the policy choices we make. I am not that optimistic that it's going to be short-lived. What's short-lived is that certain industries have contracted more than others, and some of those industries, they're already coming back. I'm not optimistic about what's going to happen with the childcare crisis. The way that women have to navigate care challenges in their life requires them to make the kind of sacrifices that put them on just a different trajectory for the rest of their career. And I think there are women that are being forced into those difficult situations right now. And I think some of these women are going to be paying the price in terms of their earnings for really the rest of their lives.
Are you optimistic that there will be some kind of attention paid to that by either the Trump administration, if President Trump wins another term, or a Biden administration, if he wins, that they will focus heavily on child care issues and women in the workforce in general?
I am optimistic that this attention that it's getting will lead to a sea change in policy, that will allow both care workers to be better treated and better paid, and families to be better supported in meeting their care needs. You know, childcare is not a women's problem. It's not a personal problem. It's a societal problem. Childcare really is the backbone of a modern industrial economy. We need care to not just allow parents to work, but to make sure that we're investing in the early childhood education that's necessary for kids to grow up and meet their full potential.
It's just unbelievable to me, Betsy Stevenson, that we're having this conversation now and we are in such a different place than we were just 6 months ago when you and I talked in February.
You know, absolutely. We saw women had made this incredible stride. They were now the majority of non-farm payroll holders, and that changed in March. Women's employment has really fallen off a cliff. And the only reason their share of jobs hasn't fallen further is men's employment has also fallen off a cliff. So they've gone off that cliff together. But when we think about it in terms of the strides women have made over the last 4 or 5 decades, you know, they're back to where they were in the 80s.
That is Betsy Stevenson, who's a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
In Florida, an appeals court has ruled that hundreds of thousands of felons who owe court fines and fees may not register to vote this election. It's the latest decision in a battle over felon voting rights that's been waged since 2018 when Florida gave them that right. And it comes less than a month before Florida's voter registration deadline for the presidential election. Across the country, millions of people with felony convictions can't vote, either because it's illegal or because they still owe money. Tennessee has one of the largest felon populations per capita in the country, and hundreds of thousands of people there are banned from the polls. Samantha Max from member station WPLN has the story of three women hoping to change that.
On August 5th, John Harrington voted for the first time in more than a decade. In a video posted on her Facebook page, cheery music plays in the background as Harrington tells the camera that she just got her voting rights restored. Just a few days before the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, no less.
So, what better time to go in here and vote? So,
Harrington masks up, dances across the street, and into the polling place. It took more than 10 years for Harrington to get all the paperwork in place to restore her voting rights in Tennessee. In 2008, she was charged with felony gun possession for bringing a licensed firearm to New York, which doesn't recognize out-of-state permits. Harrington says casting her ballot was one of the most empowering moments she's experienced since her conviction.
When I turned in my ballot, I'm like, I just started crying because I was like, you know, wow. All of this time, you know, all that I've been through ever since this, but this is one moment where I just feel in some ways restored.
More than 6 million people across the U.S. are unable to vote due to a felony conviction, according to a 2016 Sentencing Project report. A disproportionate number of them are Black. Here in Tennessee, it's about 1 in 12 adults of voting age in the state, the fourth highest rate in the country. For Black Tennesseans, the felony disenfranchisement rate is about 1 in 5. That's because even when people complete their sentences, including their parole or probation, they still have to navigate through a maze of obstacles to get their signed certificate of restoration.
And that is incredibly difficult.
That's Blair Bowie, an attorney with the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. She's helped about 1,000 Tennesseans with the restoration process, including Harrington. And she says getting all the necessary paperwork in order can be a struggle.
Maybe the clerk of court will fill it out for you, or maybe they'll only fill out half, and then you'll have to go back to probation and try to get it filled out. Some counties have never heard of it. Some counties actually charge people to fill them out. So that is a whole process in and of itself, and that can be a major, major barrier.
And Bowie says it's not just the red tape. It's also the price. Tennesseans who have been convicted of a felony have to pay off all lingering court costs, restitution, and child support before they can register to vote.
That is basically making the right to vote contingent on wealth. You can have a situation where two people were convicted of exactly the same crime and given exactly the same sentence. But if one person is rich, they'll be able to buy their right to vote back, while the other person, if they're poor, will never be able to vote again.
A bill that would eliminate those requirements has received bipartisan support in the Tennessee legislature and swept through the House in June. But it's on hold until next year because of a shortened session during the pandemic. In the meantime, Misty Dunmire, who draws disability, is racing to find a way to pay the nearly $1,000 she owes to the courts before she can vote in the November election.
I'm on a fixed income. I have rent to pay. I have a lot of other things that want to put that on the back burner, you know. And but then with Corona kicking in, I'm barely making my rent payment, you know. So it made me feel like, oh, well, it's not going to happen.
When Dunmire was in her 20s, she was convicted of two felonies for stealing to support a drug addiction. That was nearly three decades ago. It was only recently that Dunmire learned she could get her voting rights restored. She drove two counties over, eager to be the first of her friends to get her rights back. But that thrill started to fade when Dunmire learned it would cost $50 just to fill out the forms. Then, the clerk said she owed more than $900 in court costs that no one had bothered to tell her about. She knew she couldn't pay it.
And so I drove all the way over there that day with excitement and drove home with my tail between my legs with, you know, disappointment.
Dunmire says she wants to prove that she has become a productive member of society. But she doesn't have the money to make up for her past mistakes.
Because if I had the money to go over and pay, I could pay the $25 for each form. I could go ahead and pay the $900 they're saying I owe them, and I could vote. But because I'm poor, I can't. I have no, you know, my voice doesn't matter.
Dunmire is hoping she can get the court costs waived in time for the election. If not, she says it'll be just another November without an I Voted sticker. For Here and Now, I'm Samantha Max in Nashville.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. We might not know who won this year's presidential race on election night, but that wouldn't be a first. Remember 2000, when a winner wasn't declared for more than a month? That's next time on Here and Now.